Today's Teisho will be on Case 43 in the Book of Serenity. Case 43 is entitled Luo Shan's Arising and Vanishing. Introduction: One touch of the Philosopher's Stone turns iron into gold. One word of the Ultimate Principle transforms an ordinary person into a sage. If you know that gold and iron are not two, that ordinary and sage are fundamentally the same, then after all you'll have no use for it. But tell me, what one touch is it? Case: Luo Shan asked Yan To, when arising and vanishing go on unceasingly, go on unceasingly, what then? Yan To shouted and said, whose arising and vanishing is it? Verse: Severing old entangling vines, opening up a fox lair, the leopard covered itself with fog to change its spots. A dragon rides the thunder to change its bones. Bah, arising and vanishing in profusion. What is it? Well, today is the second day of our spring sesshin, and I want to thank everybody for doing a very good job this morning in the zendo. Deep sitting here in the zendo. I was very impressed. Many of you didn't take breaks during the sits, and in one case it was just so marvelous to see somebody just the bell rings and they don't uncross their legs, and the bell rings and they don't uncross their legs, and you know that the person is in deep samadhi when you see that, somebody in deep samadhi. And it was very moving to me, because I can remember many, many years ago, you know, when I first started to do Zen practice, getting through my first sesshin was an enormous achievement. It was very, very difficult, my first sesshin, sometimes I just knew I couldn't get through a single sit, and indeed I probably didn't get through a single sit without moving. It seemed like I was just in a lot of pain. Something about the experience really registered with me. Even though every sit was very difficult, there was something about the experience of sesshin that was powerful, and I couldn't tell you what it was. I just came out of sesshin with a different sort of mind. At the time I didn't realize it, but there was something about the mind I had entered in sesshin that just felt different. It felt different. And as I say, I didn't consciously realize this, but for some reason, after my first sesshin, I signed up for another sesshin. And I signed up for another sesshin, and so on and so on. And if somebody asked me, why are you going to sesshin, I'm not sure I could have said. Maybe I would have said, I'm interested in enlightenment or something like that. But that's very abstract, you know. But something kept bringing me back to sesshin after sesshin after sesshin. And now, in retrospect, you know, I can say what it was. At the time, I couldn't really say. But I remember one sesshin in particular where I was sitting pretty deeply, I thought, and all of a sudden the bell rang, and I realized that I didn't have to move. You know, up until that point, I had often barely made it through the sits. You know, it would seem like The sit would start, and it was like crossing a wire, you know, like being on a high wire in the circus, you know. You just want to get from this end of the wire to that end of the wire without falling off. And it's like breath, breath, breath. And usually I would begin to feel a sense of strain at a certain point, like, uh-oh, you know, when's that bell going to ring? I would be thinking, come on, ring the bell, you know. And, you know, so you sort of like get into concentration, and then you pop out, and the bell hasn't rung yet, and you've become aware maybe of your legs hurting. And so you try to go back into that state, and then, you know, after a while, you get to the other end of the wire, and you're safe. The bell rings, and you can relax. And I must say, some of you really relax after the bell rings. That's okay, you know. You might have a good stretch. I went through a lot of sesshins just trying to get through the sits. And I remember, after like a couple of sits, after two or three sits, I would go back to my room and I would just dive into bed, and I would just sleep instantly. I think as soon as my head hit the mattress, I was asleep. And even though you might not imagine that this is strenuous, this is quite strenuous. I mean, one of the reasons you might feel tired if you're just beginning is that, after all, what are you doing? You're sitting on a cushion. You know, if you said to somebody, I've been sitting on a cushion for the last 2.5 days, I'm exhausted, they'd wonder what you were talking about. But this enormous concentration is quite strenuous. And I would just go back to my bed and just conk out. But one day, I was sitting, and the bell rang, and I went through a period of meditation, and I realized, my gosh, I just went through two periods of meditation without stopping. And then the bell rang, and I thought, well, maybe I'll make it three, and I went through three. And I can remember at that moment realizing that, this really felt very different than my ordinary consciousness. And there's, most people don't observe their minds during the day as you're going around through your day. You don't observe it. But if you could, if you took the time, you'd probably notice it's quite a different sort of awareness than the kind of awareness we enter when we're on the cushion. Ordinary consciousness is quite broken up. It's quite fragmented, and it's quite alienated, you know. So actually, all day long, people are pretty much in a focused state for brief periods, like 2 or 3 seconds. And it's 2 or 3 seconds on this, and then it's 2 or 3 seconds on this, and it's 2 or 3 seconds on this. And usually those seconds are accompanied by various kinds of emotional states. Some of them might be very happy, some of them might be very sad, some of them are angry, and so on. So a lot of them are anxious. Anxiety, if you do observe your mind during the day sometime, it's not easy to do, but as you're just going through your day, you might become aware of how often you're anxious. Sometimes people realize this in retrospect, you know, like on the cushion sometime, you can realize, my gosh, you know, I'm so often I'm anxious. Or some people in therapy become aware of how often during the day they're anxious. But ordinary consciousness is very fragmented. It usually comes in little packages of about 2 or 3 seconds. And it's usually accompanied by various kinds of emotional states. And the underlying theme is often anxiety punctuated by various forms of hope and fear, and sometimes pleasure, right? And the other thing about ordinary consciousness is that it's very, very self-centered. And that's not meant as a criticism, it's just a fact. That ordinary consciousness is very much usually about me. And so again, if you could go through your day, if you had like a little clip on your belt, like a little counter, and it wouldn't be possible to actually do this, but if you could go through the day and you had like a little counting device on your belt, every time you thought of yourself, you just pressed the device, you know. You'd have hundreds, maybe thousands of clicks by the end of the day. That's ordinary consciousness. So it's all about me, and it's about my comfort and my safety and my pleasure and my fears and my dreams for more comfort, safety and pleasure. And this is like an ordinary consciousness day after day. And the other thing is that ordinary consciousness is very much like in a kind of state of struggle, you know, because the goal of ordinary consciousness is to basically protect the self and make smooth the way, you know, plow the road for the self as it goes forward in time. So there's a lot of struggle involved in ordinary consciousness, you know, because when we have a dream or an aspiration that we try to make real, often things are not going the way we want, and that occasions all kinds of negative emotions. And very often there's a very strong sense of like tension or conflict. This is just the ordinary mind. When you come into a Zen Sesshin, you're often at first still a little bit in ordinary mind. You know, it doesn't all happen the minute you sit down on the cushion. You sit down on the cushion. And you watch your breath, and of course these habits are deeply ingrained, right? A number of years ago, a person came to see me at the beginning of a sesshin. Somebody left the sesshin last night, and it reminded me of this person who had left a sesshin many years ago. And the person came in to see me, and the person had been practicing meditation for 5 years. And this person said to me, I just don't think that Zen is working for me. And basically the person said, you know, I've been practicing for 5 years and I still haven't achieved enlightenment. And I said that I thought that was an unrealistic goal, you know. But the person said, well, not only have I not achieved enlightenment, but, you know, I still have a lot of distractions and anxieties and delusional thoughts. And in this case, I said to the person, well, you know, how often during the day do you think of yourself, you know? And of course, it was obvious that, you know, basically we all think of ourselves all the time. Well, you know, that's the ordinary consciousness, and we're sort of like conditioning ourselves to be that way. So when you come to sesshin and you sit down on the cushion, you know, you're working against a lot of your own self-conditioning. You know, it's not anybody's fault that ordinary consciousness is the way it is, but all day long, every time you're planning something for yourself, or you're fearing something, or you're angry, or so on. you're conditioning yourself to live in a certain kind of consciousness. And when you come to Sesshin, we're trying to like decondition the mind. It's like decondition the mind. But it's not easy because you have all these mental habits that you've been reinforcing right up until the start of the Sesshin. And so when you sit down on the cushion, they're still there. But if you begin to watch your breath, if you begin to pull the mind into the moment, into the breath or into mu, you'll notice that within maybe a couple of hours, really, you begin to your mind is really operating in a different way. You know, what often happens to people is that you know, they begin to enter a state of mind which is for some people very very placid and empty, at least sometime during the first day or so. And then there's all these thoughts and distractions that arise. But even so, your mind isn't functioning the way it does when you're in your ordinary consciousness. Even if you're sitting on the cushion and you're having lots of thoughts, it's not the same as the mind you have when you're going about your business. Very different. You're aware of the thoughts in a different way. You're observing them, and you're not being dominated by those thoughts. So it's a different kind of mind. And if you just keep going, you really will enter this state which is quite different from ordinary consciousness. And this person this morning entered that state. This person was probably just trying to get through the morning, you know, the second day of Sesshin, very tired, sitting down on the cushion, maybe just thinking, if I can just get through three sits, you know. And all of a sudden you're in this mind which is quite continuous. It's like your concentration is quite a bit deeper. It's not fragmented, and it's not self-centered. It's more connected, and there's this very powerful undercurrent. It's like a kind of energy pulse. Maybe you don't experience it that way at first, but this is what we call samadhi, deep samadhi. And when you're in deep samadhi, this is this is the mind we cultivate when we do Zen meditation, this deep samadhi. It's not always possible to get there, but if you spend a fair amount of time in this state, you can experience the world in a very, very different way. And this is what Zen practice is all about. Yeah? Luo Shan asked Yan Tu, when arising and vanishing go on unceasingly, what then? Yan Tu shouted and said, whose arising and vanishing is it? When I sit down on the cushion, I try to have no expectations, but of course I have expectations. I want the Sesshin to be a successful Sesshin, and I want to be a good Zen teacher and so on and so on. And sometimes things don't go the way I want, you know. This morning I had a beautiful sit, but some mornings I get up and I sit down on the cushion and I have arthritis in my knee and that can bother me. Or sometimes things from my own life come back and I become aware of them. So the other day when I was sitting, I began to think about my dog. When I was going off to college, my parents got divorced, and my mother and my father were never very mature people, and a divorce was not their best moment. I have met people whose parents separated, and the parents were very pleasant to each other and kindly. But as a matter of fact, my parents were really hostile to each other, and the family environment was very unhealthy. And anyway, my mother got custody, I guess you could put it, of our dog, whose name was Sergeant. And mother really didn't know how to take care of animals very well. And she used to put Sergeant in the garage. And Sergeant loved to go out in the woods. When we lived on the base before the divorce, Sergeant, our dog, could go freely through the woods and wander around. And after the divorce, my mother moved off base and took the dog with her and put the dog in the garage all the time. And this was an animal who was used to running freely and so on through the forest. And suddenly it was like in the garage. And I was going off to college, and I didn't really think about my dog, you know. Anyway, I came home from college over the break, and I went out into the garage, and the dog was there, you know. And he looked so sad, you know, our dog looked so sad. He looked like somebody, like, why are you doing this to me, you know. And I was only 17. I was like really thoughtless person. And I knew he was hurting, but, you know, I had my own life to live and so on and so on. And I had no place to put a dog anyway, you know. So I went back to school, and then over the spring semester, I got a call from my sister, and she said that my mother had put the dog to sleep. You know, put the dog to sleep. I remember sitting in the library in those days people didn't always have, there were no portable phones. So I remember sitting in the library when my sister, I guess it was my sister, told me my mother had put my dog to sleep. And I started crying, and I was really sad. And then I went on with my life. But, oddly, the other day I was sitting on the cushion, And I was thinking, all of a sudden, you know, I just thought about my dog, Sergeant, and I thought, why had I neglected him? You know, why didn't I do something to try to get him out of that garage? And I felt like really like I was reliving the event. I felt this great sense of regret and helplessness. You know, what can I do? And then I was mad at my mother, and then I got mad at my father. You know, this is like 40 years later, these events are still there, you know. And I just go back to my breath, and I go into Mushin. And after a while, it all stops producing this emotional turmoil. You know, it all stops producing this emotional turmoil, and my mind became more serene, and began to be back in the moment. And now it's possible to say that that I you know, you could say I worked through that event, you know, and it's possible to say I like transcended that experience. But you know, that's not quite how it is, you know. It's possible to think about Zen practice as like transcending the world, transcending the world. You know, when this person came in to see me many years ago, the person said, I have been practicing Zen for 5 or 6 years and I still have fear, I still have anxiety, and I'm not enlightened yet. And this person was imagining enlightenment as a state of being, I guess, that's far above ordinary experience, you know, far above our frustrations and our fears and the things that bother us, like leaving our beloved dog in the garage and letting him get killed, right? But I myself have had a Daikensho experience, I still have thoughts that pop into my head like that, and they still trigger all kinds of emotions. And so you might say, well, why am I still having these thoughts? You know, why am I still having these thoughts after all these years of sitting? You know, I thought Zen practice was about transcendence. But actually, that would be a big mistake, you know. The two parts of our life, I mean, there's a part of our life which is this beautiful mind which has no obstacles, you know. It's this part of our life which is like, you sit down on the cushion and time disappears and self disappears and you're in the flow of this beautiful energy, yeah? And these moments are really like almost like divine. It's like being almost like godlike being, you know. And that is really part of who we are. And if you practice Zen, you spend a lot of time there. You know, most people spend most of their time in their little self, and maybe too much time in the little self. And so we Zen people, we try to spend more time in that other state, that other mind. We say big mind. And yet, you know, little mind is also important and very really wonderful. You know, it hurt me so much to have my mother put my dog to sleep. Because, I mean, I love my mother, you know. And yet I love my dog. My mother hurt my feelings so much. And, of course, I feel so guilty about my dog, you know. And maybe if I practice Zen long enough, I should feel like these things, I shouldn't have to feel these things. See, I shouldn't have to feel these things. Isn't Zen about getting beyond all of this? Isn't Zen about getting beyond all of this? Isn't Zen about, you know, Zen is supposed to make things go smoothly. So, you know, if I have a Daikensho experience, I'm supposed to go through life without any problems anymore. I'm always supposed to know the answer. I'm always supposed to be calm. I'm never supposed to be distressed if somebody hurts my feelings. And many people imagine enlightenment in this way. But actually that would be, that's a very distorted view of awakened mind. You know, people come to the Zen meditation hall for the first time. They come to the university and they have this image that Zen is all about bliss. And they're going to come in and sit down on the cushion and they're going to be free from all their suffering and they're going to be in a state of godlike happiness. Yeah. And many people think about meditation that way. It's like you're supposed to get serene and happy and calm. and safe and so on. And nothing is going to bother you, you know. And indeed, when people come in and sit down on the cushion, at first, they have experiences like that sometimes. They come on a Monday night or a Friday night, and they sit down and they begin to calm the mind, and indeed, it becomes very serene and very still and very calm. But if you keep sitting like that for a while, all this junk comes bubbling up to the surface. Maybe you think about the time your mother put your dog to sleep, see? Something like that. Or maybe you think about some rejection experience you had, or maybe you're in trouble at work, maybe you might lose your job. And this stuff comes bubbling to the surface, and some people just think, well, this Zen is no good, you know. This is no good. And I often say, you know, if you could just come in and sit down on the cushion and bliss out, this would be a drug, right? It wouldn't be helping you to live a better life. It wouldn't be making you more aware. It would just be like you might as well smoke opium, you know, really. And people understand that when I say that. You know, somehow we have to work through our problems. On a deeper level, Zen is not really about working through our problems in the way you might think. It's not about reaching a state in which there are no problems, or a state in which there's no longer a pain in your legs, there's no longer, nobody can hurt your feelings anymore. That would be a deeply impoverished life, you know. There's a kind of richness to life when both of these halves come together. When both of these halves come together, they're both one life. This is all one whole. You know, the part of us that is tired and has painful legs, and the part of us that can experience this timeless, God-like consciousness. This is one life. When we're on day two of Sesshin, sometimes we get discouraged because, you say, I sat down on the cushion and my mind was so clear, and now it's just, I've got all this junk I have to contend with. And if you misunderstand what's happening, it can create a lot of frustration, and it can create a lot of unnecessary confusion. You know, all of this is one life. It's a kind of a fantasy of ours that these are separate. And sitting on the cushion in doing Zen practice is all about breaking down the wall that we sort of create in our minds between these two things, you know, between this beautiful, godlike, infinite consciousness that we do experience sometimes, and this other consciousness that is nervous about this or that, or it's afraid of not being loved, or is guilty about neglecting his dog, and so on and so on. The rhythm of Zen practice is constantly moving back and forth between these two, you know, these two separate realms that seem so separate. And little by little, that separation dissolves, you know, and that takes, I'm afraid that takes more than 4 or 5 years. In fact, it's a lifetime of work. But I promise you, it's very beautiful. So if you're sitting on a cushion today, and you had a beautiful sit, like this person who I saw sitting so beautifully today, you know, congratulations. That's wonderful. And that's a part of Zen practice. Another part of Zen practice is struggling with, you know, our fears, our anxieties, our regrets. And when you encounter those on the cushion, please don't think that something's going wrong. please don't think something's going wrong. It's all one life. It's a kind of a confusion on our part that keeps them, makes us think they're separate. So if you come to Sesshin expecting blissful, godlike consciousness, you will encounter it sometime. But you're also going to encounter this other consciousness, you know, this other that is, you know, trapped, frustrated, disappointed, etc., etc. And working with both of these is what Zen practice is all about, working with both of these. And the result is the real world, right? It's the world we really live in. When you can break down the barrier between these two, it's quite extraordinary. There's a wonderful poem by a Chinese Zen master whose name was Shi Tou. SHIHTOU. And he has a poem there's some lines in the poem that go like this. He says, you know, even if you have had Daikensho, that's not complete enlightenment. Isn't that interesting? So he says, even if you can see the source of awakened mind face to face, even if you can look face to face at enlightened mind, that's not complete enlightenment. Complete enlightenment is that plus the pain in your legs, your disappointments, your broken dreams, whatever, right? Those two things, when those are integrated, that's complete awakening. Yeah? And he has this beautiful line. He says, sometimes we experience the radiance of Buddha mind, of pure, of the source. You know, sometimes we're sitting on the cushion and everything falls away, and we're just in deep mushin, and this energy is flowing through us. And we feel this tremendous sense of serenity and so on. And then you get off the cushion and something bothers you. Maybe somebody put his sandals on top of your sandals and it pisses you off or something. And it's like you're going from light into darkness, you know? It's like you slip from light into darkness. But he says, you know, actually these two things are all one. This is part of a whole, right? He has beautiful lines. He says, branching streams flow into darkness. And I love that line because our mind says these are separate, right? Our mind says not two. Our mind says two, right? But Shi Tou says not two. You know, you need both. These both make a beautiful life. But this is both necessary. This is both Buddha. You know, if you don't come to Sesshin and you're just caught up in the extraordinary confusion of life, you can't experience this wholeness that I'm talking about. But, it's also possible to have another kind of, obstacle, which is longing for imperturbable mind without any obstacles, just pure, the pure formless realm of deep mushin. And basically, you can't stop. Just to put it another way, isn't it interesting that even if you go into the deepest mushin you can possibly achieve, something is going to arise in your mind. Yeah? Isn't that interesting? So if you go into the deepest possible mushin and everything seems to disappear and you feel like you have no body and there's no time, all of a sudden you're going to become aware of something. It might be a sound, or it might be some embarrassing idea, you know? So, you know, you're in the deepest mushin, and all of a sudden you think about thought that's not a lofty and noble thought, and you think, where did that come from? You know, and you can suddenly become aware of your anger or something, you know. Isn't that interesting how that happens? And you could say, oh, I'm still not enlightened. After all this practice, I'm still not enlightened. I was in deep mushin, but now I've fallen back into the crap. See, I'm falling back into the crap. But it's not like that. See, it's not like that. You know, in classical Hindu culture, enlightenment is imagined as a lotus growing out of the filth of earthly existence. Enlightenment is imagined as a lotus. It's like, you know, you think of all the stupidity and the craziness and the violence and the selfishness of ordinary life. And we come to Sashin and we purify body, mind, and heart, and it's like a lotus rising out of the muck and the mud. But this is not the Buddhist view. See, the Buddhist view is, this world is the flower. This world is the lotus, not the muck. And the source is this beautiful, enlightened mind. I hope that makes some sense. This world is not, it's not that the enlightenment comes out of the muck. It's that this beautiful world comes out of enlightened mind. Maybe that doesn't make any sense right now, but not to, okay? Not to. So we can't have a deep Zen practice without encountering our small mind. And in fact, without small mind, you can't have enlightenment. So when we sit on the cushion, what do you know? Small mind presents itself in a million different ways. And that's such a great opportunity to deepen our big mind. So today is day two. Maybe you have a serene, empty mind, and maybe not. Maybe your small mind is quite active. But please don't think that the presence of small mind is like a failure on your part. You go into the deepest mushin, and out of mushin comes, you know, whatever. And you can't stop it, because these two things go together. And so the point is not to stop it, right? But to understand how they go together. How do they go together? The point is to understand what's happening. You know, so often, I'll stop, but so often we have this idea that something should be happening on the cushion, right? So we imagine that a certain result should a certain event should happen on the cushion, and then you should come into Dokusan and tell me about it. You might say, come to Dokusan and say, my mind is pure, not a thought has arisen, you know, and so on and so on. And you might go into deep mushin, and then these thoughts come up, and they might be thoughts of an annoying or embarrassing or mortifying kind or whatever. And you think, oh my God, this is a failure, you know, this is a big problem. But the Zen approach is not to say this is right or wrong, but to say what's actually happening here, and why is this happening? I hope that makes some sense. So the mind of a Zen practitioner is like is always trying to say, how is this happening? Why is this happening? Not should this happen. Not should, but why? Everything is happening just as it has to happen. But let's at least understand what's happening. Let's at least try to understand what is happening. Okay? So, you all are doing a wonderful job. Some of you are in a deep mushin, and some of you aren't. Some of you are in a godlike, timeless consciousness, and some of you are struggling counting the minutes. Some of you have an empty, luminous mind, and some of you are thinking about, whatever. Something you'd rather not share with others, maybe. No? But whatever it is, it's all Buddha. How is it all Buddha? That's what we're here to investigate. So please just keep going. You're doing a wonderful job. And let's whatever happens next is supposed to happen. So let's see what happens next. Okay? Read the koan. Luoshan asked Yan To, when arising and vanishing go on unceasingly, arising, form, and vanishing, formless, what then? See, Yan To says, who's arising and vanishing is it? It's just Zen spirit. Now, why is this happening? How is this, what's happening and why is this happening? Severing old entangling vines, opening up a fox lair, a leopard covers itself with fog to change its spots, a dragon rides the thunder to change its bones, bah, arising and vanishing in profusion. What is it? What is it?